Welcome to The How of Business with your host, Henry Lopez, the podcast that helps you start, run, and grow your small business. And now, here is your host.
This is Henry Lopez. Welcome to this episode of The How of Business. And my special guest today is Kevin Kelly. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to this conversation. It's a topic I find extremely interesting. But Kevin is with us today to share his thoughts and insights on how to create extraordinary places that help us connect with people. So the question that he's going to help us answer, or the questions, include: do we still need physical places like a grocery store or a restaurant or office buildings for that matter? Or, as he refers to it and others, the replacement economy. Will the replacement economy led by tech titans and retail giants wipe out these traditional physical spaces? And what about museums and universities and performing art venues? Is there still a place for these thousand-year-old institutions in our lives and in our businesses? Or are we holding on to them out of habit or guilt or nostalgia? So how do we, as small business owners in particular, create extraordinary places for our customers, our clients, our patients, our staff, and that all of that supports, or how does it support the ongoing growth of our small business? So that's what we're going to dive into today with Kevin Kelly. To get more information about the How of Business, including the show notes page of this episode, and to learn more about my one-on-one and group coaching programs, please visit thehowofbusiness.com. I also encourage you to please subscribe wherever you're listening to this episode so you don't miss any future episodes. So let me tell you a bit more about Kevin. Kevin Irvin Kelly is an award-winning architect, experienced designer, and co-founder of the bi-coastal strategic design firm Shook Kelly. As a lifelong advocate of bringing people together in pro-social settings, so settings that foster social activity, Kevin's expertise is in studying how the environment of a place affects our behavior, perception, and decision-making. So we can start to see how this is important to us as business owners who have or might need physical spaces. Since starting the strategic design firm Shook Kelly in 1992, he has worked with executive leadership teams for some of the world's most well-known brands, such as Harley Davidson. He tells a great story about that in particular in the book. Whole Foods, Kraft, J.M. Smucker, the Cleveland Orchestra, other professional sports teams, universities, urban districts, and hundreds of local and regional businesses to help them stay relevant and profitable in our rapidly changing modern landscape. In addition to being a frequent speaker at retail, food, and other consumer conferences in the U.S. and abroad, Kevin taught courses at Harvard University and his alma mater, the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. As technological replacements increasingly decimate the physical world and human interaction that comes from those environments, Kevin gives away everything he's learned in the field and the boardroom in his debut book titled Irreplaceable: How to Create Extraordinary Places That Bring People Together. Kevin lives in the Los Angeles, California area. And so with all of that said, once again, Kevin Kelly, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so much I want to ask you about. The book is excellent. When you listen to this episode, the book will have just been out, so please look for it. I'll have a link to it on the show notes page to this episode. And such a fascinating topic. But before we get there, I'm always interested in the journey. You studied architecture. Obviously, you're an architect. So thinking back to then, why did you study architecture?
You know, I'd never met an architect before. I didn't know what they do. I didn't know where they work. But at 6 years old, I decided I wanted to be an architect. It's this kind of strange divine calling that happened. And, as I'm older now, I can look back and make sense of it all. But I couldn't necessarily as a kid. But I'd say that I was hypersensitive to environments and to people. And I could tell by the way somebody walked in a room, where they sat down, how they put a key in a door, even how they put ice cubes in a glass, believe it or not, if it was going to be a stressful situation, a good situation, a mediocre one. And I started adjusting environments as a kid as just a coping mechanism. We're all scared as kids, and the world out there scares us, and the people in our lives sometimes scare us. And so I tried to calm situations down by rearranging the living room furniture, turning the lights down, turning the music up, and trying to see if it adjusted things. That's the only thing I knew how to do at maybe 50, 60 pounds. And it worked. And I moved on.
There must have been either in your personal life or maybe, you know, in school, threats, which you felt were threats, or maybe they were real, obviously.
Yeah.
This was a coping mechanism too, because I similarly,
yeah,
because of my relationship with my dad specifically, I had to read the cues and be really good at reading cues.
That's kind of what happened to me. And you know, without getting too detailed, yes, I was afraid of some domestic situations. And, you know, later in life, I learned that some people are what they call empaths, and they feel and sense things a whole lot more than other people. And you would think it's a blessing, but it can kind of be a curse in some ways, because you're always kind of feeling how somebody else thinks, mm-hmm, and little tiny inflection points. And, you know, most architects go to school because they can draw, or they love the idea of making objects. I love the idea of making people very sociable and happy and pleasant. And so I started adjusting environments, as I mentioned, not only my home, but then I started doing my friends' homes, and then I started doing the school, and it just kept going on and on. And so I kind of look at it this way, and I encourage all your listeners to look at it this way. I had a neurosis, really. I was too hypersensitive to my environment, but I figured out a way to turn that into a career.
Yeah.
And I believe that's very important to really look at who you are and what motivates you. And I never saw a business out of it, but I definitely saw a lot of kind of pride and good feelings out of it. But it eventually did turn into a business.
Right, right. When you in university, did it still feel right? Yeah, this is how I want to channel this superpower, if you will, is I want to do this. I want to be an architect.
Well, you know, I loved learning and I really enjoyed it. But I actually, it was quietly, I never had any vocal arguments, but I didn't agree with my professors. You know, we sat in a building, the architecture building, which was open 24 hours a day, right across from the art school. And I used to wonder what the difference is between art and design. And nobody could really explain it to me. And art to me is when you're doing your personal thesis for yourself, which is a beautiful thing. But I believe design is when you're solving a problem for somebody else. And what I couldn't understand in my profession of architecture is, what problem were we solving per se? So many of the projects were really about aesthetics and kind of intellectualization and what we call talkitecture. Everything, you see it in New York and all over the place, where these geometric pretzels that are twisted and people just don't understand it, average people particularly. And so I was less obsessed with style, and most of my professors were obsessed with style. And movements, the modernism or postmodernism, all these different kind of intellectual terms, abstract terms at that. I was more interested in behavior. And so early in college, I developed my own thesis, which is, again, my second principle I recommend to young entrepreneurs, is to make sure you have a thesis, a thing you want to solve. And the thesis for me was that environment affects behavior. And then I set out and spent the next 30, 40 years trying to prove that environment affects behavior. And and so that's kind of my path.
I got to think that in school, but certainly then in the real world of architecture, either, like you said, it's influenced by at the theoretical level to create that trophy building, but also then it becomes about the financial aspects of what you're designing, I have to think. Yeah?
100% return on investment. And, you know, there's a book by Ayn Rand, The Fountainhead, and many other books like this that were all kind of this idea that the artist knows best. And I always felt like that was a pretty arrogant viewpoint, and that we're using other people's money. And we kind of we're much more like stock investors, and in that, you know, we have a responsibility to return an investment for the people that entrust us with their money, particularly small businesses that don't have a lot of money. And so a lot of architects are out there trying to do their own thesis. And I don't think we should be doing our own thesis. We should be doing our client's thesis. And so I was very focused on return on investment for my clients. And it's the number one metric we use. And, you know, there aren't a lot of metrics in architecture. That's the interesting thing. Most metrics are, do you like it, or the kind of intellectual awards again. But when you start really studying behavior, that's when you can start getting a metric. And one metric can be cash register sales. That certainly is a good thing. But we study way beyond cash register sales. We start looking at dwell times, experimentation, you know, diversification of uses. When people come to a place, are they doing different things than they did before? Are they hanging out longer? Where do they stand in the buildings? You know, you might design a 10,000 square foot restaurant, but it's not uncommon to find 80% of the people use 60% of the restaurant. And so we're constantly studying, you know, where people sit, where they stand, where they seem happy, where they seem annoyed. Most importantly, where they seem social with others and antisocial, I should have said, too. Unfriendly.
Yeah. Right, right. So out of college, you went to work for someone else as an architect? Or
what? I did. I went and worked for a couple other firms. And, you know, I didn't know, you know, I guess all of us have a dream of opening our own business, but I certainly didn't know anything when I first started out. I had a lot of learning to do. You know, architecture school is 5 to 6 years, and you think you're ready, but in all honesty, you have another 5 or 6 years of learning in the field. And so I did that, and I learned all the rules I could, and I took extremely detailed notes of how people move forward in the world and how they got ahead. And I had an idea that someday I would do something. And if I could tell a real quick sideline story, when I was a kid, I used to walk to school a couple of miles, and I enjoyed it, so it wasn't a hardship. But we used to walk by this old field, and there was these hobos that would sit out in the field. And I'd see them sometimes, and I'd not see them, particularly the same old guys. And there was one guy that I was so curious about how he knew which car to take. And I said, so I just went over to him. People thought I was crazy, but I went over to him and I said, how do you know which car to take? And he said something to me that stuck with me my whole life. He said, you just know when your box car's arrived, that that's the one you need to get on. And you don't even know where it's going, but you just feel something and you run like hell to catch it. And I carried that idea with me all my life, because there's constantly a certain type of boxcar that's going to arrive. And in 1992, I just saw my boxcar moment. I said, you know, I'm going to start my own business. I was in debt. I'd been offered a principalship in another firm. It really didn't make sense on paper at all, but I went into business and with a business partner. And I'm so glad I did. But you feel that. And we've all had moments like that in our lives, right?
Yep.
Where something just calls us and you're like, do it.
Were you married at the time?
I was not. I had a kid and his mother had died. And so, no, I was in debt and I was nervous, you know, about my future. I was going to make it. And the first three jobs we got that were sure deals fell apart, but I didn't quit, you know, ever once. I just said, we're going to make it. And I was called to do this. And, you know, I have one of my clients, very, very successful multimillionaire. He's filed bankruptcy 10 times in his life. And most of us won't even come close to filing bankruptcy once.
Right.
And I thought, you know what? I could at least try once in my life, you know, and if I go bankrupt, I do, which I haven't.
And part of it has got to have been, you had the confidence, well, worst case scenario, I go back and get another architecture job. Is that fair?
Yeah. You know, the other thing, my father, I'm so thankful. He's a very conservative man, but he told me something that was really funny. He said, he called me one day and he could tell I was really nervous. And he said, you know, what's going on? And I said, well, these jobs fell through. I was like, you know, I was mad with, I don't know why him, he didn't have anything to do with it. And he said, so what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know. You know, I just hired two employees. I don't know. I got these computers that I got to pay for. And he goes, well, what happens? And I said, well, I guess I have to fire these employees. And he goes, okay. And what happens next? And he was just making me madder with each question. I said, well, I guess I have to sell the equipment, Dad. And he goes, and then? And I was like, well, then I got to move out of the house. And he kept doing this question. And finally, I said the funniest thing without thinking about it. He goes, and what will you do then? I said, well, I guess I'll have to go get a job at Tom McCann Shoes at the mall, which a lot of people don't know what Tom McCann is, but it was a shoe store. And he said, well, would that be so bad? And I remember thinking, no, I'm a hell of a salesman and I could sell a shoe. I know that.
That's brilliant. I love that he did that for you, because that's exactly how we have to think through it. What is the worst case scenario here? And often the thing we fear the most is often the embarrassment of the failure.
That's right. And the uncertainty, right? We cannot stand.
Yeah.
And if there's anything I've learned in my life, is nothing is certain. I've never been able to see 6 months out beyond my business. Period. For 31 years. So I don't know what I'll be doing on month seven.
Looking back at it, do you think that the timing was what it needed to be, or would you have jumped to starting your firm sooner? I mean, you said you had so much to learn. So what are your thoughts looking back on it now?
I was 28 years old. And, you know, it depends on what you want to do. If I wanted to do skyscrapers and the world's tallest buildings, then I needed to go work for other firms for another 10 years to really learn all that. But I didn't want to do skyscrapers. I already knew what I wanted to do. And we started right after the savings and loan crisis, which was still a recession.
Yep.
And, you know, that was the best time because everything looked up from there. And
were you already in LA at that time, or where were you?
No, okay. I was in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Charlotte, okay.
And that is where our home office is. I'm in LA now, but our home office is in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Why did you move to LA?
You know, I never ever thought I'd live out here, and I had traveled the world all over different continents, but I'd never been to LA. And I traveled out here on a fluke to do a lecture. And almost got out of the lecture 2 days before because some other stuff. I was busy on other projects, but I was like, I got to go. I need to do it. And I came out here, and within a day and a half, I thought, wow, this is a really interesting place. And I needed a geographic change in my life at the time. That was 2002.
Okay.
And I thought, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on in Asia right now, and we can't service it from North Carolina. So I came out here, and everything, you know, happened good after that. I met all kinds of people and changed. I met my wife, which is amazing, and baggage claim at LAX airport of all things. And so, you know, it's funny how your life changed. But if you'd have told me anytime in the 70s, 80s, or 90s, I'd live in LA, I'd say no way.
It's because of the perception of it's a shallow place, and it's all
absolutely
looks and all that. But what I think probably in part appealed to you, because it appeals to me about LA, is it's similar to the environment that you and I both grew up with from a diversity perspective.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And, you know, as an architect, most humans won't admit this, but we're all kind of visually illiterate, and that is our eyes are not trained to know what looks good or how things go together. And the only way you get good at that is by constantly seeing new stuff, decoding it, breaking it down, and then trying it on your own at home or with clients. And then you keep doing it, and you get sharper and sharper. And when you get into my age, you can look at a situation in just half a second and know what's wrong with it and what needs to be fixed. No different than a doctor who has lots of experience can look at a situation. And LA was so visually stimulating to me. It's like a third world country out here, and that there's just so much going on and so much chaos. And in a strange way, there's kind of this collapse. Things fail. And then like shells on the bottom of the ocean that are abandoned, and then new species take over that shell organically, not even through any planned policy or anything, and they make it work. It's fascinating to me. We have these little mini malls out here. You've probably seen them. They're all over the place. They're like 10 shops in a two-story building on a corner site, and those things fail all the time, but then they'll get taken over most of the time by ethnics, minorities that come in and then turn them into wonderful restaurants and all kind of shops and everything. And that's exciting for me as a designer. You learn a lot by watching how they make it work when the pointy heads can't make it work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. Fascinating. All right, so the book again is titled Irreplaceable, How to Create Extraordinary Places That Bring People Together. And so I'm always curious, why did you write the book and ideally who is it for?
You know, I spent the first half of my life, as did most of us, under the rules of if you wanted to get anything done, you had to go somewhere. You had to leave the house to go to work or to go to school or to go shopping, or you had to go places. And when we would go places, you know, we might gripe about it. I got to go to the post office, or I got to go to the, you know, a restaurant, or I got to go to a shoe store. But we bump into people and we have all kinds of casual conversations with people, and we learn how to socially navigate situations. And we're not only bumping into our friends and neighbors, which is really important, we're dealing with strangers, you know, people we don't know and people from other cultures. And there's an exchange that happens, and that's very important. And that started to change in the early 90s, but really changed in that magical year, 2007, when the iPhone came out, Facebook took off, Twitter was born. All of a sudden, we had a whole new world, and it was a novel, fascinating world that we didn't know, kind of like a new drug, and our behavior started changing. We became more like hermits. You would see teens just, I remember going with my brother and his daughters, and they stayed in the room the entire vacation and surfed the internet. And so, something was changing, and I could see it. And here we are now in 2024, and we've never been so divisive as from our politics. We're afraid of the other, and we don't have necessarily reasons to go out. And I get concerned about place and the importance of it. It's not just an architect's thing. It is a civilization thing. We need to go out and bump elbows with other people, to have conversations with a stranger. Is very important to us. And it hits all kinds of levels. It hits us from a cognitive impairment level. If we stay at home and don't see memories and don't have more reasons to go out, we don't remember things the same way, because the way our memories work is it's based on environment. But then it affects the fabric of our lives. If all the shops close down and all our food is run by three companies, that's a very dangerous situation that we start to live in. If main streets are closed down and the commercial quarters are closed down, crime takes over, graffiti takes over, homelessness takes over, and property values go down. So this thing it has so many kind of aspects to it. Now I have faith, oddly enough, we blame the younger generations for tech addictions, but it's really the boomers that are addicted to it. We created it. We profited from it. Some of us did. But the younger generations are starting to say, I don't know if I want this.
Interesting.
And they're starting to change their behaviors. So it's just very important that we get out and meet others in public, safe settings. That typically happens, not in the park, not in nature, although those points are important. It tends to happen at the intersection of commerce and community. Okay. For thousands of years, we've been going to the market, you know, and whatever that broader sense of the market is.
Mm-hmm. And so ideally, who was the audience you had in mind for this book?
You know, my first audience is really those businesses trying to keep from getting wiped out.
Okay.
You know, there are just tons of small businesses and operators that make up the bulk of this country. You know, local supermarkets, local drugstores, convenience stores, barbershops, restaurants, pubs, and they're trying to figure out how to survive. And we have a very proven, solid track record of helping places survive and thrive in a digital world.
I see.
And beat the pants off the other ones.
And when we're talking about spaces, I mentioned some of it in the opening, but in this context of what we're talking about here, what do we define as a space?
You know, it could be a space or a place. We use both terms, but it could be a orchestra, like I mentioned earlier, or you mentioned in the intro. We work for the Cleveland Orchestra, which is, you know, certainly trying to attract people to their venues, younger audiences in particular. It could be a Mexican grocery store chain that I'm working for down in Costa Mesa. that's trying to attract people and survive again, those big giant retail giants and tech disruptors. It could be movie theaters. It could be the malls. It could be urban districts, you know, just a whole stretch of places trying to figure it out. It can even be cities. So I'm working with several cities and trying to help them rethink, what are they going to do with these empty office buildings? Right. And how are they going to figure out a new future for them?
And you dedicated a book to your brother, Brian, who you said in the dedication, quote, taught me the value of making whatever environment you're in the best place to be, end quote. He must have been some sort of guardian for you during those more difficult times, I'm suspecting.
Yeah, he was. He was my older brother, and he passed away about 8 years ago unexpectedly. And my quick side story on that is I was too busy traveling all around, and just he kept trying to call me, which was unusual. And he's like, you know, just trying to get up with me. And as we all do sometimes, I'm like, I just don't have time to do with it. And then he called me one Friday night, and I was supposed to go out and meet some friends. And we ended up having a 2.5 hour conversation. Thank God. He died 2 weeks later from an unknown heart problem.
Is that right?
And so glad I had that conversation with him. But he and I were different. I was the conservative, studious, obeying one. And my brother, the joke we used to say was, every night's the last night of your life. And that was because he always had fun. It didn't matter where he was. He and I got stuck in the woods out there that you and I talking about earlier, out in the mud flats for, you know, over 36 hours. And we had the best time ever because he can just make wherever a great time. And I always learned that. I was like, you know, just make wherever you're at the best place to be.
This is Henry Lopez, briefly pausing this episode to invite you to schedule a free coaching consultation with me. I welcome the opportunity to chat with you about your business plans and offer the guidance and accountability that we all need to achieve success. As an experienced small business owner myself, I understand the challenges you're experiencing, and often it's about helping you ask the right questions to help you make progress towards achieving your goals. Whether it's getting started with your first business or growing and maybe exiting your existing small business, I can help you get there. To find out more about my business coaching services and to schedule your free coaching consultation, please visit thehowofbusiness.com. Take that next step today towards finally realizing your business ownership dreams. I look forward to speaking with you soon. So speaking of the mud flats, and I think that's at the heart, and I'm hoping you can share a little bit of that story, because the bonfire effect, as you refer to it, has its roots from your experiences there. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I didn't grow up, you know, in a sophisticated place. I grew up in a very rural place. To get to my house, you had to go down a dirt road that would rattle the fillings out of your teeth. And my house was kind of raised up high off the ground because of the swamps. And there wasn't a whole lot to do but build buggies and swamp buggies, we called them, and airboats and motorcycles and four-wheel drive vehicles that could traverse the swamps. And it had its own beauty. Most people don't understand that about Florida. They think of beaches, but
right,
there's this whole other world out there, the Everglades. And we'd spend all our time building these vehicles, and nobody ever really coordinated this, but every Sunday, everybody in the whole city, if you were anybody, and I shouldn't call it a city, I guess the town, we would drive out to the mud flat to take us about an hour and a half to get there. And you drop all kind of drive shafts and axles trying to get there. But if you got out into the middle of this kind of swampland, there was a redneck Riviera that kind of raised up from the ground. And I was always fascinated because I was going there since I was a little kid. And again, being observant, at close to sundown, a self-organizing group of men and women would get together and start collecting branches and twigs and boxes, and they'd build a bonfire. And I'd watch them build that bonfire. And there was always what I call a bonfire master. That was the person that really knew how to put it together, because you can't have that flame too big or everybody will run off and you can't have it die down. But then it would get this group of rednecks, me included, all around this bonfire. And we had something that Carl Jung later describes as participation mystique. It's this idea that you feel one with people. around kind of a mystic quality. And we'd all look at that bonfire and drink beer and listen to Lynyrd Skynyrd and, you know, just have a good old time. And I carried that with me all the way out here to Rodeo Drive and Melrose Place. And I see it everywhere. I see these bonfire moments where people get together and really hit kind of a social bliss. And I'm very fascinated when that social bliss happens. It doesn't happen at a Kmart. You're not going to see it there.
Right.
But you'll see it at a lot of places, a lot of these outdoor shopping centers. You'll see it at certain restaurants. You'll see it at certain retail places like Wegmans, where people just feel a kindredship with each other. And that's where I know the environment's affecting their behavior and making people feel pro-social. So I'm really about trying to create those bonfire moments.
It seems to me that it taps into it in what you experienced as a kid in a very unpolished, rustic way, into that tribal mentality that I believe we all have. And so it fed that, right? And of course, it was the mesmerizing thing of a fire that we're all still fascinated by. But it created that environment. It happened kind of organically, right? There was no elected leader in that case. And seeming chaos kind of came together, and then this thing happened and it created a magical moment.
That's exactly right. And the key thing to me that I never forgot is that we crawled through mud to get there.
Right.
Almost like crawling through barbed wire. Like it cost us money, time, and effort to get to this place, a lot of work. And if you survive the mosquitoes just to get out to this thing, that is the standard that physical places and spaces have to use today.
Yeah.
They have to create something that has a payoff. And the thing I look at all the time is the internet and the replacement economy is all about ruthless efficiency, rock bottom pricing, reach and scale. And it reduces everything down to just, it's all the same. It's undifferentiated. And what I think, if you're going to survive to be a place, you have to, it's going to take more work. You got to get in your car. You got to dress up. You got to park. You got to, you know, navigate other crowds. The payoff has to be bigger. And that payoff can't be cheaper prices, because nobody beats the internet. If there's 900 million mattresses online, you're not going to have a bigger store than the internet. So you have to give a social payoff, a recreational payoff, a leisure payoff. And we're social animals, and we're wired to be around each other. Our entire bodies are designed to read other people and read their faces and read their language. And something happens in the right kind of configurations where people will come together. And, you know, they do something in the right kinds of place. They'll meander, they'll mill, they'll bump into each other, they'll talk to each other, they'll say hi to each other. Those things are very important to our happiness and our sense of fulfillment, our sense of belonging.
It comes to it. Yeah. So beautiful. Thanks for that. You know, how does this apply to us now as small business owners? I'm a big book reader, and it's really big to my big dismay that so many bookstores have gone out of business, at least, you know, in the suburban parts of the world. It is. Yet in Manhattan, where my daughter lives in the Upper East Side, a new Barnes & Noble just opened. It's a different version. It's a smaller footprint. But it still, I think, gets pretty good, this idea that we're talking about here. And then you share in the book a company you've worked with, Harley Davidson, and how they have fostered, and you have helped them foster. Can you tell us that briefly, how they're doing that?
Yeah. I mean, they're in my mind one of the greatest brands in the world. I mean, there's a couple that are just, you know, cult brand status type of thing. And it's just amazing to be around their culture and to be around dealerships. It'll make the hair rise off the back of your neck when you get to a big Raleigh where all of the people are coming together. And, you know, I was fascinated with it. When I started working with them, I was trying to figure out, you know, what this was about. And as I dug down deeper, they don't win on the track anywhere. What they call metric bikes, you know, the bikes from Asia or Europe are the ones that are the fastest and the cheapest and easiest to finance. And so I was trying to figure it out. I'm like, so what are we selling here? And it was a big hunk of metal. And the joke I said, and jokes are very important in business, because inside a joke is a truth. And so the joke I said to my staff when we were pulling our hair out one night working on the assignment, I was like, I think the assignment's this. I think we have to figure out how to sell the slowest, fattest, most expensive, hardest to finance motorcycle to midlife crisis males fading in strength. And everybody busted out laughing. And we thought, my God, there's a lot more truth to that than we admit. And it's an exaggeration, but it was an exaggeration that was really important. And then we said, so then why are we putting the bike on the pedestal? Mm-hmm. Why don't we put the end of loneliness on the pedestal? Mm. And that's
and what time frame are we talking about here that you were doing this work?
Oh, this, I'd worked for them for a long time. So this was probably 12, 15 years ago.
Okay.
And so maybe not 15, probably 12 years ago. And so we started really thinking about, well, how do we build bonfires at a Harley-Davidson dealership? Right. And we literally built bonfires out front. And then we started thinking about how do you move up in this world? And one of the most fascinating insights that they gave us, or I guess a challenge that bred an insight, was the parts and accessories counter of a Harley-Davidson dealership is one of the areas that was getting hit hard by the internet. Internet was just destroying that.
Yeah. And the really bike is hard to buy online, but the parts and the accessories and the embellishments, easy enough. Yeah.
You can get knockoffs everywhere.
Right.
And yet the dealers, and once that happens, if you stop buying from them, then they have a hard time just keeping it there. And it kind of becomes a negative spiral. So they start going, why keep it if people are going to buy it elsewhere? But I noticed this really odd behavior, and this goes back to just constantly being observant, is that I'd watch people walk in the store, a certain type of rider who wasn't a brand new beginner, but also wasn't an expert, just a journeyman or journeywoman in that process. And they would go back and they'd start talking to the parts guy, like almost annoying him. And I'm like, what are they doing? And then I watched them tell stories, and they would tell stories. Oh, did you hear what happened to Jim? They're like, no, what happened to Jim? They're like, oh, he was driving the bike down the road and some old guy, you know, made a turn and he sped off the corner. His gas cap fell off and the whole bike caught on fire. And then I was holding my breath. I'd hear these stories over and over and different types of stories. And they'd say this line at the end, but he's still riding. And this was interesting to me because it was the way you moved up in the culture. And a lot of these people were in their 50s. And there's a rider that I discuss in the book named Ernie. And, you know, he wouldn't ride his bike on the highway because he was terrified of it. So he just rode his bikes up and down. He had multiple bikes in his cul-de-sac neighborhood, terrorizing his neighbors with this potato-sounding muffler. But he wouldn't get out on the road. And he told me himself, he said, I don't know what I'm going to get into. My wife's figured out her life. My kids are gone. He's like, what am I to do? I'm not going to sit here on Facebook all day. And Starbucks isn't for me. And SoulCycle isn't for me. And I remember him patting his belly. He's like, I need something. And what he was telling me was, I need a place that flatters me and makes me feel like a hero. And the Harley dealerships do that. And so we started really developing them more as headquarters and really encouraging people to hang out there, which broadened it to a whole bunch of other riders who ordinarily wouldn't have come there, because now all of a sudden they had a place that they could call their own.
Now, but if I'm not a Harley rider, but I've observed it and these destinations that they've created all around the country, that predated this work. So was it a tweaking of that model that was the end result to facilitate more of that gathering and community?
Yeah, I think up to that point, they were, it's really around 2007, you know, right before the Great Recession. I have to think about my dates, 2004, that we started our work. And there was just a transition going on, and the focus, the community aspect has always been there outside the stores, but not in the stores.
I see.
And the stores had more of a traditional car salesman model.
Okay.
And we were really trying to diversify that to make it more of a community-minded model.
That makes sense. Okay. As we continue to apply this to small business owner like myself or who might be listening, what are some of the, and especially if we're dealing now where it's really a challenge, I get the distinction here on the parts and accessories, but you know, the motorcycles themselves, you're probably not going to buy that online. For a lot of us as small business owners, we might be trying to sell something that's more of a commodity or it can be easily bought online. So for those types of businesses, what do you see are some of the common mistakes that you observe that, you know, specifically retailers are making with their spaces? Is there a couple of things that stand out to you?
Yeah, I mean, if we were to walk a store together, and I do this all the time with executives that have been in business 30, 40, 50 years, and I'll show them a way of seeing their stores as they never have. And, you know, I'll give you an analogy. When you go to a movie does an incredible job of making you forget the outside world within a minute and a half. Mm-hmm. It pulls you into the drama and it crafts every scene. That doesn't happen by accident. It creates a series of scenes and it's directing your eye towards the parts they need you to go to, the gun in the drawer, the shadow in the background, you know, the wolf down the road. It's very good because the human eye is incredibly adept at picking out the most vital information blocks. We don't scan every pixel of a screen, and nor do we scan every pixel of our world. We pick out vital information blocks, and we're essentially looking for two things. Yeah. We're looking for enhancements to our lives and impediments to our lives.
Yeah, the danger and the pleasure, right?
That's right. And we swim towards those things that are good, and we avoid those things that are bad. And so when I help small businesses, which I do a lot, the first thing I want to see is, what's your first scene? What's your arrival scene?
Okay.
Where do I go next? And oftentimes I'll walk into whatever business they have, and the first scene is not set up right. Now we're talking consumer scenes. I'll see half of one department, half of another department. And the way we describe a scene is that it has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and a mini climax in the middle of that scene, something. And so I'll give an example. In a grocery store, it might be the pizza making station, but it'll be the fire for the pizza. And if somebody's spinning the pizza out of it with a paddle. But beyond that, that mini climax needs to impart some kind of important story, some kind of value, like we believe in quality ingredients. But after I get out of that pizza station, we need to get you to the next station, the next one. And all of those scenes need to add up to an overall belief, a theory of how the world can be corrected through your business. Most of us live, if I can extend this, most of us live in a state of balance and imbalance, where constantly the world seems balanced, we feel good, and then it seems imbalanced. And we go through that all day long. And we look to retailers oftentimes, or brands or businesses, to help us solve problems. You know, that's what a business essentially is a problem solving entity or a problem solving system. And the thing that businesses have to be clear about is, how do you put the world back in balance?
Yeah.
And what does balance mean right now? More time with my kids, or more safety at home, or losing weight? What is that balance? And the venue you have needs to support that. And it's not going to support it with one idea. It's generally going to be about 6 to 8 scenes that really pull it together. Now, for those businesses that don't have consumers walking in their business, but just have an office building, say, or an office environment, and they sell a service, the same things apply in terms of your employee culture and how you bond and how you connect. My advice to anybody with any kind of space, which is every one of us, we're always in a space, is to observe how people behave and really go, did we get along really well in the living room? Did that work? Or do we do better in the conference room? Or is everybody hanging out in the kitchen, and why the kitchen? And those are things that we really try to spend a lot of time noticing and fitting together. And there's no business I go to that can't improve itself.
Mm-hmm. And it starts by certainly me as the owner taking the time to observe how people behave in my spaces and in my competitor spaces and in other spaces.
Absolutely.
And learn from that.
And the thing you'll get that, you know, where do I get my biggest ideas? And, you know, being an innovation firm sounds cool, but every single day, every single week, and about 20 times a year, we have to come up with a game-changing idea, because we don't sell any kind of, you know, architecture by the yard. People hire us to change the rules of their industry. Where do we get our best ideas from? They don't come from my head. Like I just invent it, which is the way a lot of architects want to think that they're the magician. They come from observation. And what I really look for are anomalies. That is the secret to me, is what is the odd little thing that somebody did? It may be what they wear, how they talk, or what they laugh at. And that's what I'm trying to always notice, is there some little odd anomaly, something that's happening that I didn't really realize? And I'll drill into that more and more and more. And that's oftentimes where we find some of our biggest breakthroughs.
And is it the bad anomalies or the good anomalies or both?
It's both. And it's often the one that people, they dismiss as nothing. Oh, that's nothing. Right.
I got to think that the good ones might be harder. It's obvious to us. Okay, this is broken. The receptionist isn't greeting anybody. The lobby is ugly and dated. All of those things are obvious. But sometimes it's in when it's working to really, why is it working?
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's 100% right. We will notice when something's working well and when it's not working well. And so many companies will do surveys and what we call formal surveys and get quantitative data. Yeah. We use tons of research firms to do that. But really, the best insights we get are from watching body language. 90% of communication we can observe from the body. I'll give you an example. You know, we work in the convenience store industry, trying to figure out where are we going to get an insight to help this chain, that $1.5 billion chain, do better. And a lot of times we'll just sit out in the parking lot. We'll bring lawn chairs and just sit out there and for days. And I can't tell you the number of people I'd watch pull up in a gas station so fast you thought they were going to drive into the store. I was worried. And they were on the cell phone with their music blaring. And they'd walk into the store and they'd walk about 10 feet into the store and they would do this tiny little thing over and over and over through 50 different stores. They'd walk in there and they'd go, huh. And what we saw in that little huh moment was they couldn't remember why they were there. They were so distracted. And when we showed our clients videotapes of that, we were like, we want you to watch this. That's when they said, you know, in all our years, nobody's shown us that they're still heading 60 miles an hour into the store and they're halfway into the store and they still didn't realize why they're there.
And so what's the takeaway from that? Why does that insight matter to them as a business owner?
Well, they lose sales because the customer doesn't remember and they grab one item, soda, and they walk out and they drive 40 feet down the road and get a donut from another store. Yet we have the same donuts, Dunkin' Donuts, in that store. And so what we have to do is divide their intentions. So we have to change that behavior as they get there. And we have to make it so interesting that they would put that cell phone down and stop.
You're slowing them down or stopping them. So they can remember in a good way. Right. Exactly. Not by career, not by, oh my God, where the heck is that?
Not by giving them an obstacle.
Yes, exactly. An obstacle course. Yeah.
Giving them something so enticing that they would slow down and go, I'm very interested in that. Check this out. That's what you want them to do.
And I don't mind spending a little bit more time here now that I'm here.
Absolutely. And we see it and we'll measure that, what we call basket sizes. We'll see their basket sizes increase from their average purchase. So in this particular chain, and I could name many different examples, but in this particular chain, who's experiencing all kind of forces from the big retail giants and the tech disruptors, is that we ask them, and I ask this question over and over in companies, how do you make money? And they go, well, what do you mean? We sell stuff. I'm like, no, how do you really make money? And I'll keep asking that question until they give me the best answer. Sometimes I've asked you 30 times. And they said, we make money when people get dispensed drinks. I'm like, huh, what do you mean? They're like, when they get that soda, that big gulp,
high margin,
or they get a coffee, or they get this, not the bottled one, not the canned one. When they buy it out of that dispense, we make money. And we're like, okay, so what's a big, hairy, audacious goal? What would be just something crazy? And they're like, oh, you know, they just said, we could sell 1,000 drinks a day in a store. That'd be unbelievable. We're like, okay, that's good. We love a problem. So my team and I go back and we're like, what would get people to buy 1,000 drinks a day in a store, all the customers in a store? And so we designed this whole new kind of billboard-esque football stadium of drinks, essentially what we call freeze, fizz, and fuzz is what we did.
I see.
We did not change the product. We didn't change the price. We didn't change the service. And we increased sales in 5 prototype stores. We wanted to test it across 5 stores without changing the store data criteria. We increased sales by 86%. So this tells you how much environment affects your behavior. Now, we divided their attention to the point that they would put the cell phone down and take a look at it because it was that energetic and that stimulating. You know, the internet does it all day long, right?
Yeah.
It's clickbait in a way. We're not trying to do clickbait. We're trying to do engagement. We're trying to pull you into the experience and get you to enjoy it. There is this tendency out there, and we get it all the time, for people to think we're manipulating them. But we're very, I'm not a capitalist at heart. I'm a human and I'm a humanist. And so we don't want to manipulate people. We really want them to enjoy their time and have fun. And we want to save small businesses. And so we're constantly really trying to figure out, well, how can we save you from Amazon or Walmart or somebody else? We're trying to figure out, how do we help you survive and thrive?
Yeah. And I think that the consumer might allow you to manipulate them once, but rarely will they allow you to manipulate them consistently.
Yeah, we're not manipulating you any more than a movie does, right?
That's right. That's right.
And
you're influencing, you're helping me make a choice. You're helping me enjoy the value that you have to offer. And if I do that well, I'll come back for more.
And if you help me enjoy my time going grocery shopping, like if instead of looking at it as a chore, right, I look at it as recreational leisure or enlightenment, that's a great feeling.
That's
our test. We don't, that's just not a, you know, idealistic goal. That is our minimum bar. We're like, they have to enjoy it. They have to, we kind of think of humans like batteries. And if our building is draining you more on your way out, then we're not doing our job right. We have to fill the customer's energy tank with fuel. We have to really make them feel inspired. And again, you may not think that's possible, but think of all the great grocery stores you've been to. Again, whether it's Wegmans or Whole Foods in the old days or HEB, these places fill you with energy and make you feel inspired.
Yeah, we have the Publix chain down here in Florida, beautiful, which I think does a great job of that.
Unbelievable.
Well.
Yeah, one of the best grocery stores in the United States.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Mm. Okay, we'll start to wrap it up. I could talk to you for hours about this, but we'll begin to wrap it up. The book, again, that we've been referring to that has all of this thinking and shares all of this intelligence and how to do this is, again, titled Irreplaceable, How to Create Extraordinary Places That Bring People Together. And the author is Kevin Kelly, who I've had the pleasure here of sharing all of this knowledge. What's one thing you would have us take away from this conversation that we've had from a small business owner's perspective, like myself? I might be planning to open a retail location, or maybe I own a franchise business. What's the one key takeaway that you would like us to take from this conversation?
Pay attention to your surroundings and how they affect people, and try to figure out how you stand out in that. If you're in the business of trying to attract customers or even employees, try to figure out how your environment really reflects who you are, how it tells your story and manifests the kind of value you bring to the world, whether you're a business owner or whether you're a store. You got about 2 seconds to communicate to people what your place is about. And so in the work we do, we don't have 20 minutes. We really got to tell them why this place has profound value that you need. And we do that by reading cues and triggers inside spaces, symbols and icons. We're really highly adept at humans at really picking apart a place and going, that's what this place is about.
Excellent. Beautiful. And you help people do this at Shook Kelly. Just give me again briefly, who's your ideal client at Shook Kelly?
You know, we work for a lot of retailers, food businesses, food companies. And as I mentioned earlier, we work for some cities and urban districts, which is a lot of fun. But any place that has any company, I'm sorry, or institution that has a physical place where they want to gather people. And that can be an orchestra, as I said earlier, it could be a mall, or it could be an urban district.
And where should I go online if I want to learn more about Shook Kelly and the work that you guys are doing?
There's two sites for my book. It's Kevin Irvin Kelly, and Irvin is E-R-V-I-N, and Kelly is K-E-L-L-E-Y.com. So KevinIrvinKelly.com is where you can find information about the book, Irreplaceable. And the company's website is ShookKelly.com, ShookKelly.com.
Wonderful. Thanks for sharing that. We'll have links to that. If you're not where you can write it down as you're listening to this, I'll have all of those links on the show notes page for this episode at thehowabusiness.com. Kevin, as I expected, a fascinating conversation. I didn't even get to half of the questions I wanted to ask you, which means I was just enthralled with everything you had to share. This topic fascinates me, and you're so expert at it, expert level, and an incredible communicator. Thanks for taking the time to share with me and be on the show today.
Thank you for letting me a part of it. I think the world of your show, and I think the world of your audience. So I really appreciate being a part of it, and I hope my answers weren't too long-winded.
No, it was great stuff. Very inspirational, very educational. This is Henry Lopez, and thanks for joining me on this episode of The How of Business. My guest today again is Kevin Kelly. I release new episodes every Monday morning, and you can find the show anywhere you listen to podcasts, including my YouTube channel, The How of Business YouTube channel, and my website, thehowofbusiness.com. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to The How of Business. For more information about our coaching programs, online courses, show notes pages, links, and other resources, please visit thehowofbusiness.com.